Hello and welcome to yet another installment of the DVD Marquee on HDF Radio, sponsored by the Home Theater Forum in collaboration with iCraveDVD.com. My name is Shane McDonald and I'll be your host this week, and with me as always is Garth. Jeffrey, actually.
Party on, dude! And I'm 40-something years old and I don't feel comfortable saying that, but I thought I'd give it a try.
Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth. Wayne, Garth.
I think we got that backwards, but oh well, let's go.
Well, I can't believe that we're up to show numero 5.
Yeah, it's flying along pretty well.
And they said it wouldn't last, so we've got another half dozen silver platters to talk about this week. But first of all, I'm kind of excited about a couple of things I read prior to our taping today. And do you mind if I share some nice DVD news with the wonderful people out there?
Go nuts.
Okay, big news for fans of classic comedy. Just found out that Paramount Home Video announced earlier this week that they will be releasing the long-awaited initial batch of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis movies on Tuesday, June the 13th. The Martin and Lewis Collection Volume 1 will be comprised of The Caddy, Money from Home, Sailor Beware, the previously released twofer of My Friend Irma and My Friend Irma Goes West, That's My Boy, and two of the funniest movies I've ever seen, Scared Stiff and Jumping Jacks. You know, I had a chance to look at the artwork on a post via the Home Theater Forum, and it is a beautiful caricature of Dino and Jerry in their prime, which was drawn by the wonderful artist Al Kirchfield. So that's June 13th. And I'm hoping we'll be able to get a copy to review in advance, because I just love Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. Just classic stuff. Another pair of highly requested films that people have been wanting for years are coming from Fox in June, also on June 13th. Valley of the Dolls and the infamous sequel, the cult classic Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, co-written by, would you believe, a young Roger Ebert and directed by the legendary Russ Meyer. Yes. The movie that gave us the classic line that Mike Myers borrowed for one of his Austin Powers flicks. This is my happening and it freaks me out. Anyway, how was that? Was that better than the Darth and Wayne thing?
I'm not going to comment.
Okay, and I'm glad you're not Simon Cowell. Okay, finally, a little closer calendar-wise. Matter of fact, a few days from when you guys are hearing the show out there is Warner Brothers' Busby Berkeley Collection. It's due out Tuesday, March 21st, all of the classic movies with that eye-popping choreography, barely dressed dancing girls, and hypnotical camera angles that still look amazing some 70 years later. Can't wait to see the lights of the Footlight Parade, Go Diggers of 1933, and the bonus disc, which has about 3 hours of nothing but the best of Buzz's tenure at Warner Brothers. And we'll try and take a look at that on the future show, if we possibly can. But right now, let's get to our 6 movies of the week. And Shane's going to kick it off with a review of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Shane?
So,
Harry?
Watch yourself on the stairs. It's a bit icy at the top.
Okay, thanks. So?
Yes?
I just wondered if you... I just wondered if maybe you want to go to the ball with me?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
I was just wondering if maybe you wanted to go to the ball with me.
Oh, Harry, I'm sorry, but someone's already asked me. And... well, I've said I'll go with him.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Fine. No problem.
Well, we're into our 4th year at Hogwarts, and Harry Potter has grown by leaps and bounds. This movie's a little bit darker. It's got a new director again. We've got Mike Newell taking over the helm. The only problem I had with the film is it seemed a little chopped together, almost too quick. Now, reading reports on the web before the movie came out, they were saying that they could have made two films out of this. It might have been a good idea. Now, I haven't read the book, so I really can't compare them.
You know, I've only seen the first two Harry Potter movies. I'm not a Potter maniac like some people. You know, I don't camp out to get the books or anything like that. But the first two intrigued me, and the one that makes me look forward to this one is that they're, you know, they seem to be growing up. And I did not know until I talked to my best friend Stan, is that in the books, the characters age as well. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, so now, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's an ongoing story, right? Every year, they're obviously going to age as it moves along. They're just aging faster in the movies than they do in the novels.
Now, the first two movies were directed by Chris Columbus, and then the third one had a different director, and this one has yet another director. Was that a good or bad thing for this particular film?
I think it made the film a little more adultish, considering the age of the characters themselves. They are getting up there, especially Daniel Radcliffe and Rupert Grint and Emma Watson. They're all aging, and they're, you know, around that 15 years old age, so making it a little darker will appeal to a new audience rather than the younger audience.
So it's not going to be a case where these actors are going to be replaced in another movie. Do you think that they'll be in the same roles? I think there's like 6, maybe 7 books in the series.
The next movie might be their last. They may have to recast. I know they're signed on for that one, but I don't know anything after that.
Well, tell me about the disc, Shane. I mean, it's a 2-disc special edition, widescreen and all that. What's all the goodies for the Potter fans that haven't yet bought it?
Well, the DVD itself, the video, I had a problem with personally. Now, on my 32-inch CRT television, there was some blockiness during the dark scenes, like big, huge squares of different colors, mostly like grays and whites and beiges and along those lines. But then when I tried it on my computer, everything played fine. And then when I tried it on an LCD screen, I didn't have that blockiness. But then the fog scenes were all pixelated. So I don't know if it's the display or something to do with the transfer, but I did have some problems with it. The color palette, they played with it a bit to give it a bluish color in a lot of the scenes, and some of the characters look a little blue. But overall, it's not too bad. It's not disappointing. It's nothing to return the disc over.
You know, it's just kind of unusual because this is like the second post that, or second complaint, rather, that I've heard about a recent Warner Brothers transfer, and they're usually top of the line. So it's kind of unusual, but then again, nothing to write home about. You think that most people, you know, we're supposed to be the picky ones, you know, but you think that most people will be satisfied and won't really care?
I don't think a lot of people would even notice it. We're scrutinizing it, right? The audio, on the other hand, much better, in my opinion. We get to see the Quidditch World Cup in this film, and it really uses all the speakers so well, especially when Crom comes into play. It just livens the room. Just every speaker's firing, the sub, the surrounds, your fronts. Really well-placed audio coming from each. The only complaint that I have is they replaced John Williams, who wrote the score for the first three films, with Patrick Doyle, and you can actually tell that it is a different score. It doesn't have the same oomph that typical John Williams scores do.
So what about some of the special features?
There's a lot of special features. There's none on the first disc. I got the 2-disc special edition, and there's absolutely none on the first disc. The second disc takes you through 4 categories, which is really nice because you're able to go through all the challenges for the Triwizard Tournament, and then you can go to Hogwarts Castle, and that's where the bulk of the extras are. And they also included a game so that you can play the challenges yourself of the Triwizard Tournament, so you can take on the dragon or navigate the underwater competition or make your way through the maze and even try to make it back from the graveyard. My favorite feature, though, was probably the Into the Deep feature, which is the second task. And it's all the underwater filming about how they went about doing it. And Daniel Radcliffe had a log where he spent over 49 hours underwater to film that scene.
Wow.
Yeah, so
that's got to be some kind of record.
It's pretty intense.
So you think you'll be going to the Olympics in the next 4 years?
Probably not.
It was either that, or they could get him. You know, it's a shame they couldn't get him a role in the Poseidon remake that's coming out. But 49 hours—that's a long time.
That is a long time underwater, for sure.
So no commentary?
There's no commentary, and that's a little disappointing.
The others had commentary? I think that maybe the first couple with Columbus had commentary.
The first three did have a commentary.
So probably, you know, I can see it now, double dipping before Christmas. I can see another edition of this coming out, but just, you know, don't get me started about that. But for the most part, you're satisfied with the transfer and the film itself?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I'm glad I picked it up.
Okay, and the next movie is yet another film that I haven't had the privilege to see, but I've heard a lot of good things about it, and it's the, I guess we can go ahead and call it an anti-war drama in a way, Jarhead.
Yeah, Jarhead. Very interesting flick. Released by Universal, and I got it just today, but it came out last week. Or for those of you listening to it, that would be March 7th.
That's about all I know about it. It was released last week, so Shane, you're going to have to fill in the dots here. But
yeah,
it's
based on a novel by Anthony Swofford, who is actually the lead character in the film. It's a very slow pace, not quite as bad as Lord of War, which you might remember from one of our earlier podcasts, but it does have Jake Gyllenhaal in it. He's fantastic. Jamie Foxx, also incredible in this film, and probably the best movie that I've seen Peter Sarsgaard in. I didn't like him in his last film, which was Flight Plan, so really good.
And the movie, if I understand correctly, doesn't really have a lot of war action in it, and the basic story is this tremendous boredom that these kids, you know, waiting to do battle, there's really not much battle for them to do.
Yeah, it's all about sending them to war, and then there being no war for them to go to. So you kind of start feeling bad for the soldiers who had to be there during that whole time, and this is based, like, Anthony Swofford was actually there, and that's why the novel was written. It's based on his real-life account. And there's a couple... There's a couple of moments in the film that you do, like, when I say there's a boredom, but there are other moments where your adrenaline starts flowing and you get all pumped up and excited, and then all of a sudden...
And it basically follows the basic premise of the story. It's like, you know, you're setting yourself up for something, you know, really big, like something out of, say, Patton or Saving Private Ryan, and it never comes.
Yeah. There's this huge, huge buildup, and it just keeps going and going, and then the war's over.
So you like the performances?
The performances were amazing.
Gyllenhaal's had a heck of a year. I mean, Brokeback Mountain, this film, and there's another one that I'm straining to remember, but just he had three really good movies last year, so he's really on the roll. And as far as, now, this is the single disc version. I understand there's a two disc version, which, believe it or not, may be possibly out of print, but you're just talking about the single disc version, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about the single disc version. The two disc is available if you can find it in stores. I know they sold pretty quick, but it does contain a lot more. On the single disc, we get two commentaries. One's from director Sam Mendes, and we get a lot of information from him and his desire to make this film. And then we get another one from the screenwriter, William Broyles Jr. and Anthony Swofford himself. And this is...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is an awesome commentary to listen to, especially when he starts going into details about his experiences while he's there.
You know, I had forgotten about Sam Mendes directing this. You know, he did American Beauty, which is one of my favorite films of all time. And William Broyles also, I think, was responsible for the screenplay for Castaway and the Jodie Foster movie, Contact. So, you know, those credentials, you know, I'm looking forward to renting it very soon.
Mm-hmm. There's also 11 deleted scenes that they threw on here that has optional commentary. They basically explain why the scenes were cut. He's also, Mendez is accompanied by the editor, Walter Murch, for these little commentaries. But there's one scene that I wish they would have left in because it would have made the joke a little later on in the film make more sense. They also have the uncut news interviews, which are when reporters come to talk to the Marines and ask them all sorts of questions. It's all chopped together in the film. These are the uncut versions of those. And they also have a commentary by Mendez and Murch. And then probably one of the neatest features is Swofford's Fantasies. Now, this played a pivotal part in the book, and they really wanted it in the screenplay, but they were forced to cut it due to time constraints.
Right.
And it basically just shows Swofford fantasizing different scenarios for the situation he's in. Like, in one scene, he's getting reamed out by a drill sergeant, and he pictures him in a dress.
You are no longer black, or brown, or yellow, or red. You are now green. You are light green, or dark green. Do you understand?
Sir, yes, sir!
Swofford.
Sir, yes, sir!
You the maggot whose father served in Vietnam?
Sir, yes, sir!
Outstanding! Did he have the balls to die there?
Sir, no, sir!
Too bad. He ever talk about it?
Sir, only once, sir!
Good. Then he wasn't lying.
So, you know, it kind of puts it into a different perspective in his head, so he's not as scared of him.
Right.
And again...
Well, I'm telling you, you know, it got a lot of initial buzz, but just, you know, when it came out, I guess the critical consensus was not as good as maybe, you know, the filmmakers had hoped. But I've been hearing really good things about this movie, so I'm hoping that it's going to have a second life on DVD, and I'm really glad to hear you give it a positive thumbs up.
Well, I think the other thing, too, that kind of hurt it theatrically was the other Gulf War in Iran or Iraq or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So I think that affected it. So. But now, Jeffrey, I understand that you've got an interesting documentary to look at.
Jane, yes, I do. And it is called The Year of the Yao, an affecting involving documentary of the 7-foot-plus NBA superstar Yao Ming, which arrives this week courtesy of New Line. Filmmakers James D. Stern and Adam Del Deo were given pretty much free rein to document his historic first year as a member of the Houston Rockets, from his selection in the NBA draft to the pivotal final weeks of the season as the team vied for a playoff berth. And in between, we witnessed the highly valued prospect go from being the toast of every major sports magazine cover to a tenderfoot in a disastrous first few games. Now, despite a media backlash and forced life from the likes of Charles Barkley, Rockets coach Rudy Tomjanovich doesn't give up on his prized rookie, bringing in the likes of NBA legend Bill Walton to assist and help him turn things around. And in an unforgettable showdown for the highly touted Los Angeles Lakers and the imposing Shaquille O'Neal, Ming finally lives up to the hype by going toe-to-toe with his rival, with the underdog Rockets coming out on top before a stunned Staples Center crowd and an equally shell-shocked Shaq. Say that 3 times fast. But Year of the Yao doesn't limit us to courtside. We're also privy to the special friendship that forms between the Chinese round baller and his American interpreter, Colin Pine, who becomes more than a spokesperson, but a trusted friend and surrogate little brother, tagging along from endless press conferences, photo shoots, publicity jaunts, and all the other rigors that sports superstars have to endure. We also see just how influential and popular Yao was in his homeland nearly a decade earlier, when the media microscope honed in on him at the tender age of 9. Now, although I'm not a huge NBA fan, I truly enjoyed the well-made look of one of the sport's most talented players, and I think even non-fans will find it interesting to watch.
Now, I read somewhere on the web that Chinese scientists actually bred the tallest man and tallest woman they could find to basically create Yao Ming. Is there any mention of that on the documentary?
I don't think so, but, you know, I mean, certain things may be behind closed doors, you know, that we'll never know about, but just he is a very huge individual, and just bless his heart, almost every room he goes to, he has to duck his head, and just, you know, I hope he's not going to develop back problems in the years to come, but just, it's very well done. He's a very soft-spoken person, very polite, just a really down-to-earth person, and just in the midst of all the media, you know, scrutiny that he was under, he handled himself with a lot of grace, and just, I was really impressed. I walked away impressed.
Yeah, I heard that for one of the All-Star games that his limo broke down and he took the bus.
That's right, that's right. One thing that I was going to mention, the only real supplemental feature on this disc is an hour of deleted scenes. You know, just about 55 minutes, almost an hour. And some of the stuff, I think, should have been left in the movie. And there is one, which you just mentioned, He was, en route to the NBA All-Star Game, which was being held that particular year at Phillips Arena in Atlanta. And they had some trouble with a limo. And Colin just said, well, let's try and take a bus, And just the people were just like, stunned when they saw this, 7'5" Chinese kid getting on the bus. And you think, most people, you and I know that a lot of sports figures have, egos beside the fact system. He didn't seem to mind getting on the bus. He was having a really good time and seeing the sights and everything. And it was actually kind of a nice change of pace. And another deleted scene, which I wish they would have left in. He's on his way. Yao is about to shoot a commercial in Los Angeles. And it's morning time, and as most, healthy athletes do, take their vitamins, take it with a glass of water. Well, Colin or somebody in the limo hands him a glass of straight gin, and he proceeds to just drink it in one gulp, and all of a sudden, Yao just realizes, it's not water, and he just kind of gets a little numb, a little red-faced, and it's just a funny human moment, my only complaint about the film is that sometimes it's a little too serious, a little too dour, a little too dramatic. I think moments like, the bus sequence and the accidental, gin shots would probably have lightened things up. But otherwise, I have no complaints about this film. I think NBA fans, diehard Houston Rocket fans, diehard Yao fans will find it much more entertaining than I did. But even I, enjoyed it immensely. So I highly recommend Year of the Yao.
Excellent. That's good to hear. Now, I understand that we're going to have a little bit of a quick recap on A History of Violence, which we covered in a previous podcast, mainly because you were able to check out the rest of the extra features on it.
Yeah, Shane, the only thing that I did not cover in my wildly enthusiastic review was the commentary track. And it's very, very well done. Cronenberg takes us through every aspect of the story, what influenced his decisions on how to shoot things. And one thing that I found extremely interesting was the Western influence. And, you wouldn't think by looking at this film that it would have kind of a, an Old West feel, because, nobody's wearing chaps or cowboy hats or silver spurs or what have you. But it's a small town. It's a guy, who used to be, one of the bad guys, but trying to turn his life around, not unlike Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven. But you have these bad guys coming into town looking for their old buddy. And also the music. Cronenberg explained his musical decisions and how he wanted something to sound like his old movies, like, John Ford movies and what have you. And it's a really interesting commentary. I mean, I think it's more for the scholarly type people. There's not a lot of, say, gossip or anything like that. But I think it's enjoyable. It's not the best commentary track I've ever heard, but I think it's worth listening to. And as far as the film itself, my goodness, don't get me started again.
I won't.
It's out officially. I don't know how much more praise I could have heaped on it, but it's one of the best films from last year, and I truly hope that it gets an even larger, well-deserved audience on DVD. And History of Violence, the new line, it is out this week. And I believe I'm going to throw the ball back in your corner. You've got a movie with one of my favorites, the lovely Naomi Watts, and it's the movie called Stay.
Yes, Stay. It's interesting because reading the back cover of this film, it mentions supernatural horror, and I didn't really find anything supernatural or horror about the film. It's a very bizarre movie. It also has Ewan McGregor, you'd mentioned Naomi Watts, and Ryan Gosling, and it's directed by Mark Forster. Yeah, it kind of feels like an M. Night rip.
Kind of like the Sixth Sense kind of feel, that kind of deal.
Yeah, kind of feels like that. There are some good performances in the film, though, from all three mains. Bob Hoskins is also in the film, and he turns in, for the little part that he has, it's really well acted, and there's a lot of broken camera rules, if you will. You know that 180-degree line that you're never supposed to cross when filming? Well, that line doesn't exist in this film. The ending, which is supposed to be a shock ending, I could see anyway, coming a mile away. So I was a little disappointed with it, but it was interesting enough to continue watching it all the way through, and I enjoyed it, despite all my negative comments.
So, is this an extra-laden disc? I know it didn't do well at the box office, but does it have any other goodies on it?
It does have some goodies on it. There's two different commentaries on it, but they're scene-specific, so there's only about 14 commentaries, if you will, in total, because there's, I believe, 7 scenes, and each one is covered. And the first one's with the director, Mark Forster, and Ryan Gosling, and it's not really a good commentary. I didn't enjoy it all that much. The second one has Mark Forster, Matt Chassay, Kevin Hogg, and Roberto Schaefer, and it's a little more insightful. Now, they never really said what they did except for Roberto, and I don't remember what it was, but it still doesn't remit. You know, it's not really a good commentary because it's only on certain scenes. It would have been nice to hear everything on the film,
right,
like an all the way through. One other feature that they do have on the disc that I thought was kind of interesting, but I don't really believe in that jazz, was Departing Visions, which is a look at people's near-death experiences.
You know, I find that those types of commentaries where it's just only for certain scenes work. Say if you have a full-length commentary contained, and then maybe scene-specific with an actor whose schedule is kind of crazy and they weren't able to sit down for, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours. But it just doesn't, I'm not really happy with that. That just doesn't, you know, even though it was not a major box office hit, still, you know, you would prefer to just, you know, have somebody talk about it from start to finish. But just, you know, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I enjoy the full-length commentaries a lot better. Although, the one thing I have to say, it was a lot shorter to listen to.
I hear you.
One of the other features that was pretty neat was on the music of Stave and how they created basically new instruments or new sounds to give it kind of the eerie feel that they're trying to emote from this film, and it worked. It worked. I really enjoyed the score in the background.
So I'm taking kind of mixed feelings about this.
Yeah, for sure. I'm definitely going to recommend it as a rental. Fans of Naomi Watts, though, may pick it up just because she's in it.
Yeah, I'm a big Naomi Watts fan. I think I would probably watch her read the alphabet on a remake of The Electric Company. That's how big a fan I am. But anyway, enough about that. To wrap up our show, I'm sorry, Naomi, call me. To wrap up the show is a film that I'm kind of curious about because it got mixed reviews, but it's a film called Chicken Little. What'd you think about that?
I didn't know what to think. It's Disney's first outing without Pixar from their own in-house animation studio, and it fared very well at the box office, but in my opinion, it's good, not great. There's too many little tiny flaws throughout the movie, like just little mistakes that it's almost as if the film got ahead of itself in some ways. There was just so many little flaws that it didn't seem to flow properly. However, yeah, the voice acting, though, really helped carry this film. Zach Braff from Scrubs, Chicken Little.
He's great. I love that.
Totally awesome. And this is probably one of my favorite lines from him in the film right here.
Who are we talking about?
Now, accompanying Zach Braff is Joan Cusack. She's Abby Mallard. And Steve Zahn is Runt of the Litter.
Oh, Steve Zahn. Love Steve Zahn.
Yeah, he's definitely a good voice for Runt of the Litter. Steve Zahn's great. That's basically the main group of friends. And my favorite character in the film is Fish Out of Water. He's hilarious. He's zany. He's a goofball, you know, and I like to be a goofball sometimes. So I think that's why I identified him. And there's one scene in particular that I really like, and I don't want to wreck the film, but let me just say, King Kong. That's all. And when you see it, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's a great one for the kids. My daughter loved it. And it was really, you know, it's not a bad film. It's just not as good as it could have been.
You know, a few weeks ago, I was watching Ebert and Roper, and they were talking about Curious George. And Richard Roper, you know, kind of dissed it, you know, saying that adults wouldn't have anything to do with it, and it's certainly not for the adult audience. Would you compare Chicken Little as being in that same vein? Do you think it'll play better to kids than people our age?
I think it appeals to both ages, actually. There's a lot of adult references. Like, in one scene, they mention an alien face hugger. So how many kids out there are going to know that's from Alien? Right? There's a lot of little comments that are dropped that, unless you're a movie fan, that you'll probably miss.
You know, the only problem that I had with the clips is that I think they were trying just a little too hard. They were straining a little too hard for laughs. Is that the impression that you got as well?
Not really. I think the laughs came just naturally. Little flaws in the story is really what hurt it.
Yeah, I wondered about that because, you know, so much of Disney stuff, you know, whether it's in Pixar or, you know, in-house, has just, you know, met with a lot of critical acclaim. And this is like one of the few in recent years that just did not get a lot of good buzz.
It's a shame. It's like I said, it's not a Pixar movie, if you will, but it is good.
So what's on this? I'm actually surprised that it's not a double disc, and I'm willing to bet you it will be probably in a couple of years, but for right now, single disc, right?
Single disc, for sure.
What's on it?
There's some good stuff on this disc, especially for me. I'm a Bare Naked Ladies fan. They have a music video for One Little Slip, which is the opening sequence song performed by the Bare Naked Ladies, and it's basically them in the recording studio watching the intro and playing the music along to it. Then there's One Little Slip karaoke, and they when I actually went to a preview of this a little while back, if you remember in one of the earlier podcasts, I said that I'd went to Disney to get a preview of some DVDs. They showed us the karaoke version, and it actually was new footage that they made specifically for this karaoke version. But then they also have the sing-along, which just adds the lyrics. So it's the exact same thing as the karaoke, except where you can hear the lyrics. One thing that my daughter and I had fun playing today was Where's the Fish trivia game, where they ask you trivia for the film, which obviously I answered. She's only three. But she loved finding the fish because they put them in a little square, and then they move them around and you have to find them. So she thought that was pretty fun. And then there's five cleverly titled making of features, so everything from the incubation period to ruin the roost.
So fun for everybody the whole way around as far as the extra
stuff. It's pretty good for a single disc edition. A two disc would have given a little bit more, but it's a typical Disney single disc edition. The video on it's pretty good, especially considering it came from the digital source. So there's no noticeable flaws. And the 5.1 was pretty good. The only problem was with the actual score. It sometimes overpowered the ambient sounds that they were trying to create to help build the atmosphere for that particular scene. Yeah, I'd recommend it. I'd probably recommend anybody with kids will probably want to buy it.
Well, it sounds like a pretty good rental possibility, and I think I'm going to take you up on your positive review of Chicken Little. Man, we have just breezed through the show, haven't we?
We certainly have. It went by a lot quicker than our previous ones.
I hope so. You know, just we'll find out in post-production. But, you know, I opened up the show talking about some titles that I'm looking forward to, and I think you made a little checklist, wish list. Anything you want to talk about before we wrap this puppy up?
There's one cartoon set coming out next week that I'm looking forward to, and that's Batman Beyond Season 1. Big Batman fan, so anything Batman-related, I really want. I can't wait for King Kong either. That's another set that I'm really excited to pick up.
Yeah, we're keeping our fingers crossed that we're going to have a review of that for our next show. But, you know, right now, I'm almost afraid to jinx it. You know what I mean?
I hear you there. I hear you there. And, of course, I'm really looking forward to the Chronicles of Narnia.
Which is out the first week of April, right?
First week of April. April 4th. Very excited for that disc.
You know, I never got a chance to see it, but just everywhere I go, from like bookstores to, you know, specialty shops and stuff like that, it's just Narnia, Narnia, Narnia. Kind of like Marsha, Marsha, Marsha on the Brady Bunch, but it's gotten a lot of great, you know, buzz, and I'm looking forward to it. It sounds like a really killer movie.
Saw it twice in theaters, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So I can't wait to get a third helping, if you will, on DVD.
And I'm sure you'll be the first to solve it.
I will. I might carry anyway on like you in a history of violence. Well, that wraps up another episode of the DVD Marquee. It's time to hang up the mic and thank the good folks over at the Home Theater Forum again. And, of course, iCraveDVD.com. That's weird plugging my own site, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much. And, folks, we will see you next time on our next edition of the DVD Marquee. Thank you for being there.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for everything you've done for me in my entire life.